I don't think the church has ever seen such a display of honors and awards which have come from the academic world. I may just make reference to a few. He was the second Mormon elected to the National Academy of Science in 1945. The first Mormon was Harvey Fletcher in 1935. Some of the major awards he received in 1948, the Achievement Award in Chemistry. In 49, the Bingham Medal from the Society of Rheology. In 51, a major award, the William Nichols Medal of the New York Section for outstanding contributions to theoretical chemistry. In 1954, he was asked to give the first annual G.N. Lewis Memorial Lecture at Berkeley. If you were to see a list of the individuals who have given lectures, there are approximately 6 or 7 Nobel laureates. I recently asked Kenneth Pitzer of Berkeley why Henry was selected to give the first lecture. He said because there was no more perfect choice than Henry Eyring. Speaking of G.N. Lewis, who's considered the father of American physical chemistry, a chemist wrote to Ted Eyring after Henry's death, "We shall not soon see another so gifted as your father. Scientifically, he ranks with his hero, G.N. Lewis, on the top of the mountain, and his personality gave him a mountaintop all his own." In 1960, he was awarded the $50,000 Petroleum Research Fund Award. There were hundreds of nominations from across the country. 5 scientists were selected to receive the unrestricted grant from the American Chemical Society. In a letter to President Olphin, the letter stated that the University of Utah should be very, very proud and fortunate to have on its faculty a man of his unique caliber. In 1962, he became president-elect of the American Chemical Society. 63, the G.N. Lewis Award for Scientific Achievement. 64, the Peter Debye Award in Physical Chemistry, another major chemical award, and also president-elect of the American Association for the Advancement of Science. 65, the Franklin Award for Achievements in Theoretical Chemistry. 66, the National Medal of Science, which is the highest award bestowed by the United States upon a scientist. 67, another major award, the Irving Langmuir Award in Chemical Physics. To receive this award, you must have made within 10 years of prior to the award a major contribution to chemical physics, which debunks the myth that Eyring ceased to be creative after 1946. In 68, J. Willard Gibbs Medal for fundamental contributions to nearly every phase of physical chemistry. In 69, the Crescian Medal for contributions to theoretical chemistry, the Linus Pauling Medal. And also in that year, an international symposium was held on Sanibel Island in Florida. 230 scientists from around the world gathered to honor Henry Eyring and his contributions to atomic, molecular, and solid-state theory and quantum biology. I read through the list of scientists, and it is indeed impressive. In 1971, a major symposium in honor of his 70th birthday. For the Richards Medal for conspicuous achievement in chemistry, and the Joseph Priestley Celebration Award, which is given to the most outstanding American scientist in any field. In 75, the highest award of the American Chemical Society, the Joseph Priestley Medal for distinguished services to chemistry. In 76, he was honored with Linus Pauling, John Byler, and Louis Feather as a giant in chemical education. The citation read that the work of these 4 men could not be measured and that they had left legendary reputations. In 78, the French Society of Physical Chemistry honored Henry with a symposium. In 79, the Royal Swedish Academy of Science bestowed the Berzelius Medal in gold in honor of the 200th year anniversary of Berzelius's birth upon Henry Eyring. This is the only 10th time the award was ever given, and Eyring has been the only American to have received the award. In 1980, he received the $100,000 Wolf Foundation Prize in Chemistry. We know that the committee for the prize, we know two of the three names. The two names we know were Nobel laureates. From all the chemists in the world, they selected Henry as the sole recipient of the prize in chemistry. And in 1981, in Berlin, Germany, there was an international conference gathered to celebrate the 50th anniversary of Irene's and Polanyi's famous paper on simple gas reactions. And the circular for that conference stated that this paper marked the beginning of chemical dynamics as we know it today. A man 30 years old writing a short article, which 50 years later was honored in an international conference. Well, and then after his death, we have found two international journals and three American journals dedicated to his memory. Given his unique stature in the scientific world, the decision has been taken to create at the University of Utah the Henry Irene Archives, and we have given a brief description of that project. You might notice that in 1989 we have planned to publish a biography of Henry's life and thought titled Molecules and Mormonism, The Science and Life of Henry Irene. George Boyd, his brother-in-law, put it succinctly, chemistry was Henry's vocation, Mormonism was his avocation. And he was as well known a Mormon as he was a chemist in the scientific world. And I may tell you a couple of stories. They were rather quite amusing. In 88, we will publish a volume of his most important scientific papers. And then a number of researchers and scholars will use the archives to write more technical journal articles illustrating, documenting, and explaining the unique contributions which this man has made to science. Just a few quotes from some chemists. What I am saying is that those of us who encountered Henry Irene in the church, I don't think ever appreciated just how unique he was in this century. I think his mannerism did not lend itself to anyone suspecting that inside that cranium resided a gifted mind. I've heard him speak, and he was very common and down to earth. In fact, one person in Arizona wondered if Henry really knew anything at all after hearing him speak. He disguised his genius well, which is itself, I suppose, a mark of genius. One chemist wrote, "The Wolf Prize is a reaffirmation of what many have known for so long. Namely, you are one of the most unique and towering figures in the history of chemistry." Another chemist, "If there ever was a glorious scientific life, it was his. He was perhaps one of the most colorful scientific figures. And America has to offer the world two of the most colorful chemists, and the persons of Henry Irene and Linus Pauling. In the history of science, his name will be linked with this cherished absolute rate theory. I cannot think of any greater achievement in physical chemistry from 1925 to the present date." Another chemist, "I am aware of the unique team of Hugh Taylor and Henry Irene, who together created the strongest department of chemistry in the world between roughly 1935 and 1945. Henry Irene is absolutely unique in modern times in terms of the breadth and interest of his research. One of the textbooks which he wrote, titled The Theory of Rate Processes, writes Sidney Benson, was probably known to more physical chemists of this century than any other scientific text, excepting perhaps Pauling's Nature of the Chemical Bond. Irene's contributions as a scientist are matched by very few in this century, and his qualities of a man by even fewer. His skill as a chemist, his imagination and intellectual courage in all areas, his brilliant technical presentations, and his unfailing sense of humor placed Irene among the greatest scientists of a wonderful scientific age. And another, "Irene was one of the greatest theoretical chemists of our age, perhaps of any age." Well, I think you get the message. This is cute. My problem is, after rereading some of your classic papers or books or listening to some of your stimulating lectures, I come away with the feeling that no one can be quite that good. But I guess you are. For over 50 years, Henry Eyring ranks as one of the world's leading theoretical chemists, and he has left a lasting and indelible impression upon chemistry and physics. As Urey put it, Henry Eyring was one of the principal architects of physical chemical theory of the 20th century. He was not only a great chemist, but he was a great Mormon. And he often dragged religion into science in a very polite way. I recently interviewed Glenn Seaborg, who was director of the Atomic Energy Commission and a Nobel laureate in chemistry, and I asked him, did Henry ever try to convert you? Oh, yes. And he often prayed for me, and I appreciated that. In 1976, the California section held a symposium honoring the Nobel laureates in chemistry in California. Henry was invited to participate, and he was asked to give the invocation. So, in spite of some of the fears of some of our brethren, not all is lost with science. In 1939, Keith Laidler came to work with Henry at Princeton on a British Commonwealth fellowship. After 3 years, it became clear that Henry could not convert him to Mormonism. And this is from an interview with Keith Laidler. And he said, when I got ready to leave, Henry took me off to the side. And he said, you know, Keith, my religion teaches that if you're worthy, one day you will become a god and inherit a kingdom. I hope to be worthy and myself inherit a kingdom, and thereby I will have considerable influence. I will make sure that you come into my kingdom and we will continue to work on scientific problems. Both amused and deeply touched by Eyring's sincerity. In Berkeley in 1947, I don't know if I'm preempting President Mern, I heard the story from him. Henry gave a lecture to a group of scientists at Berkeley. At the end of his lecture, indicated that if they wanted to hear something really important, they should come to the Mormon church Sunday night where he was speaking at a fireside. 1948, in a speech in Reaction Kinetics to the National Academy of Science, the most distinguished scientists in the country. At the end of his talk, Henry raised the question of how or who did the universe get wound up. He was absolutely delighted that no one ventured to answer the question. And it was a subtle message of his faith in deity. Henry had a broad vision of science and Mormonism. To him, the important thing was to affirm the existence of a creator who organized the world out of pre-existing matter, and that all else was relatively unimportant. I may conclude my remarks by quoting from a letter which I sent to all the general authorities of the church with a description of our project. Part of the letter said this: as some voices in the church attack the integrity and motives of mainstream science, Henry's broad vision and testimony helped many Latter-day Saint scientists stay true to the faith. Evolution and the age of the earth were interesting scientific questions, but were not, in his perspective, of religious importance. In some marvelous way, Henry would testify, God created this wonderful world, but his faith did not hinge on how or when. As many members labeled each other and threw each other out of the church on these issues, Henry sought to embrace them all and bring them to God. I would hope that Eyring's legacy as an outstanding scientist and as a firm believer in tolerance and charity and allowing a healthy form of pluralism in the church could remain with us. It seems to me that this very humorous and funny man, in many ways naive, childlike in his faith, boyish in his attitude, uninhibited, absolutely honest, but it was this kind of figure who passed among us, which seems to me that in a world and in a science and in a church which all too often take themselves so seriously, Henry Eyring is a breath of fresh air. Now we will hear from Professor Hume.
Robert asked if I'd talk a little bit about the science and life of Henry Eyring. I suggest that you read my article if you want some on faith and science and Eyring's relationships with the church, that you read the Dialogue article that was published about 2 years ago, a year and a half ago. It's been my great pleasure to work with whom I consider Mormonism's greatest scientist, without a doubt. I spent 2 years at the University of Utah, one on a full-time basis and another on a part-time basis, working with Henry Eyring. And it was a great privilege and a great experience for me. On one occasion, he wrote, "Undoubtedly, the prospective scientist should arrange to be born with the right genes. Anyone who has examined the variations to be found among individuals with ostensible equivalent training cannot escape this conclusion. However, even the gifted individual requires a stimulating environment." Well, I can assure you that Henry Eyring had those genes. He was born with the right genes, and throughout his entire life, he enjoyed a stimulating environment. He was born on the 20th of February, 1901, in Colonial Juarez, Mexico, in the Mormon colonies, to Mormon colonists Edward Eyring and Caroline Romney. In 1912, and you can read some of these in his son's book, his reflections on being driven from Mexico in 1912 because of the revolution. They were unable to return to Chihuahua, and so Henry Eyring spent his youthful years in southern Arizona in the neighborhood of where Spencer Kimball lived. There are definite evidence, even at that young age, that he had a brilliant mind. In 1919, he won the Graham County Scholarship for $500 and went to the University of Arizona to study mining engineering. And he graduated in 1923, and then the next year completed a master's degree in metallurgy. During that time, he found he had a great aversion for mines and smelters and a talent for chemistry, and so the next year he accepted a one-year instructorship at the University of Arizona in chemistry. And by the way, he had very little chemistry at this time. I think you could almost count on two hands all of the courses in chemistry that Henry Eyring took in his entire life. In fact, at Berkeley, when he goes to Berkeley in 1925, he gets a fellowship, and he's quite frank about why he went to Berkeley. He says they gave him $50 more than Chicago. So he went to Berkeley to study chemistry under G.N. Lewis and his staff. He actually worked with George Ernest Gibson and produced the first thesis on radiochemistry at Berkeley. Of course, Berkeley is quite famous for its radiochemistry, but Eyring was the very first individual to do any radiochemistry. He soon gave that field up. At Berkeley, you had to have a minor for anyone who majored in a major field, there had to be a minor, and he chose mathematics, and I think that was an appropriate choice. Well, I guess I felt some kinship with him, being a mathematician of some sort, but it was also extremely useful throughout his career as a theoretical chemist. He had a great deal of mathematics. In fact, you can't count the number of mathematics courses he took at Berkeley on two hands. But anyway, with the credentials of a Berkeley PhD and a G.N. Lewis recommendation, he found employment at the University of Wisconsin in 1927. And Wisconsin was really an important turning point in his scientific career. He was still working on radiation chemistry and radiochemistry when he went to Wisconsin, but he came under the influence of Farrington Daniels, also a great physical chemist of the early part of this century. And They worked on the decomposition of nitrogen pentoxide. You know what that is. He was also at Wisconsin able to attend the lectures of John H. Van Vleck. And Van Vleck was America's greatest teacher of theoretical physics. He had just returned from Europe and was all fired up about the great possibilities and the potential of quantum theory. And in 1928, physical chemists were extremely interested in quantum mechanics, and Irene began looking at the questions and that it proposed and the solutions that were offered. He was a little bit feisty in those days, young, he went to the department chairman on one occasion and told him that he didn't feel like that the department would amount to a hill of beans if he continued running the physical chemistry department the way it was. He essentially said it wasn't being taught by the best people. Of course, he wasn't teaching very much physical chemistry, and I think that's one of the reasons for that. And the department chairman, I think, was rather irritated because he found a nice, convenient way to fire Irene by securing a National Research Foundation fellowship and sending to Germany for a year. And, of course, that's where Irene came into contact with Michael Polanyi, who had three great careers, first as a medical doctor, then as a great physical chemist, and later as a social scientist at Manchester in England. But he and Polanyi wrote this famous paper on gas reactions in 1930, and basically what it amounted to in simple words was Henry Irene was able to take a look at, have a picture. In the case of a three-atom reaction, was just a surface like going out in the hills. You have mountains and valleys and things like that, and Henry Irene could look at the chemical reaction and see a picture, a physical picture in his mind of what happens in a chemical reaction, and knowing some about the surface of that surface, the picture of that surface, he could calculate reaction rates. And as I say, it was a whole new world, and if Henry Irene was not a kineticist after Farrington Daniels at Wisconsin, he was after Berlin for the rest of his life. In fact, he thought almost entirely about reaction kinetics for the next 50 years. Towards the end of his stay in Berlin, he was approached by Wendell Latimer at Berkeley, who had come to see what Irene had accomplished there. And Berkeley asked Irene to come back for a year. In fact, Joel Hildebrand was on leave the next year, and so Henry Irene came back to Berkeley for the 1930 year and worked on the halogen-hydrogen reaction. And the study paid off in some very interesting ways. All of you, I'm sure, who have had any chemistry know that when you put hydrogen and fluorine together, you get an immediate explosion. And Henry Irene said, not so. My calculations show that that's not possible. In fact, he said that hydrogen and fluorine would not react without considerable activation energy, and shouldn't even take place unless you reach temperatures of 150 to 250 degrees centigrade, which is very, very hot if you're boiling temperature of water is 100 degrees. And so he decided, I guess we better prove to the world that I'm right. And he and a postdoctoral friend, Lewis Castle, prepared pure quantities of hydrogen and fluorine and proceeded to mix them at room temperature at Berkeley. And the result was as they had predicted with their quantum chemistry calculations, no reaction. Even after 30 minutes of direct contact, there was no reaction. Realizing they would have to sweep the dangerous gases out of the chamber that they were mixed in, they arranged for a nitrogen gas line to flush them out. And then they sought safety across the room behind a large table. But they forgot to run the nitrogen hose over to the table. They debated for a few minutes who would go over to the nitrogen tank and turn the valve to flush out the mixture. Irene finally agreed, and he proceeded to crawl on his hands and knees across the room, and as soon as he reached up and turned the valve, the mixture exploded. The flask was pulverized, the enclosing towel cut into shreds, and the wire-end glass safety screen cracked in a dozen places. Presumably, this explosion was initiated by sulfur or talc or some catalytic material from the fresh rubber tubing from the nitrogen supply. Henry Irene, of course, was not hurt, although he has some interesting stories to tell when he was at Princeton. But he decided after that little episode not to try the experiment with liquid hydrogen because of the explosions that would have happened had it ignited. Well, vindicated, he was invited, by the way, by the American Chemical Society to come and speak at a special symposium on the applications of quantum chemistry quantum theory to chemistry at Indianapolis in 1931. And at that 31st of March meeting, 1931, he impressed youth Stott Taylor at Princeton University, and Taylor on the spot invited him to come to Princeton from Indianapolis to give two lectures to his faculty. They were even at that time looking for someone to fill a vacancy that they had. Because of the Depression, they offered Irene only a one-year contract. But he decided to go, and of course his 1 year at Princeton turned into 15 exciting years that have been spoken about. I might say that the 1931 paper has been honored, but I think there's no question that after 3 years of vigorous hard work, and Henry Irene was a tremendously hard worker, he was in the lab from early morning to late night, and his son even told me he thought about chemistry on Sunday. But anyway, in 1934 he was to present another paper on the fundamentals of reaction kinetics to the ACS in Cleveland. He went to Utah on a vacation, came back. On the way he was in an automobile accident, fairly serious one. It put him in the hospital for 2 weeks. He says, "I spent more time on my paper, more than usually," said, and he later recalled that the result was as finished a paper as I've ever written. The paper was called "The Activated Complex in Chemical Reactions." I don't recommend too many of you reading it, but it is by far the most famous of all of Henry Irene's papers, and the one in which most historians, when you read the history of chemistry, that paper is listed as one of the famous ones. Well, Irene received wide recognition throughout the world in the early 30s. There were three major applications of rate theory at Princeton, which he developed extensively at Utah. One in liquid theory, one in rate theory applied to bioluminescent bacteria, fireflies. Fascinating study that he worked with Frank Johnson at Princeton beginning in 1942, and of course later develops into many, many aspects of biology, rate theory applied to biology. He'd really worked on it before with heavy water, had some fascinating experiences with heavy water in the 30s. Irving Langmuir, when they went to the meetings in Philadelphia, Irving Langmuir said, took Henry Irene off by himself and says, "Hey, you tell me about it, we'll let you, Taylor, tell everyone else." And so he had some great experiences there. In 1944, he was asked to be the acting director of the Textile Institute, a very, very strange appointment, it seemed to me, and yet Henry Irene applied absolute rate theory to stretching fibers and things like that. Eventually, his investigations would lead to the general problem of what we now call deformation kinetics. Henry Irene was a leader and a founder of those studies. One other thing that really didn't relate to to his rate theory research at Princeton was his work on optical rotation, and I won't say much about that in lieu of the time. But I need to say two things about his books. Those two graduate textbooks are probably, I think, the most significant thing, maybe the most significant contribution to chemistry in my mind. The first, in 1941, The Theory of Rate Processes, presented Irene's absolute rate theory in a way that could be understood by the average worker in physical chemistry. For advocates of the importance of activation energy in reactions, it became the Bible of chemical kinetics and largely replaced the earlier theories which stressed the importance of collisions in chemical reactions. The second book, in 1944, Quantum Chemistry, was written to acquaint chemists with the use of quantum mechanics in chemistry. Thousands of chemistry students have used them in the intervening years. In fact, The Rate Processes is a graduate textbook in chemistry, has sold over 30,000 copies in the United States, and that doesn't count all of those that are pirated and sold overseas that are not pirated. I think one of the significant tributes to Irene for his books came from his graduate students at Princeton. They nicknamed them the Jewel and the Green Diamond. The first, they felt, was a real jewel, and the second was harder, and I can agree with that, trying to read a little of it. And since the cover was green, the only appropriate title was the Green Diamond. Henry Irene was one of the great physical chemists of the 20th century. Though many in this audience, I'm sure, will see his most significant contributions in other areas, principally those in connection with the University of Utah and his relationships with the church. In the world, he's known as a chemist. He thought about molecules almost every waking moment, and even when he slept. It's appropriate that this symposium honor this remarkable genius. Thank you.
Somewhat personal. He was a very dear friend of mine, and such a monumental intellectual figure that I think it's most appropriate for someone or some organization that has some connections with the LDS Church to do something special to recognize him. Therefore, I'm delighted and greatly pleased that Sunstone would have arranged this symposium in his honor. In my opinion, there is no Mormon in the whole history of the church who has achieved anything comparable in intellectual life to the achievements of Henry Irene. And I have a feeling that the Mormon people generally have not recognized this, are simply not aware of it. I had recommended a number of years ago and urged the first presidency of the church to do something special to honor this man. But I was never aware that anything special came along. I suppose that one of the problems may have been the fact that he is a brother-in-law of President Kimball, and it's a little bit difficult in a situation like that, I suppose, for the church to have a special honor for one so intimately related to the president. But certainly, in spite of the fact that the church has produced scientists of competence in profusion, and some very exceptional people, such as Harvey Fletcher, a world-recognized physicist in acoustics who has already been mentioned here, and others whom we could name, there is, I am sure, none who is as monumental a figure in the sciences as Henry Irene, and I should add, in no other intellectual pursuit in the church in its entire history. This man is unique as an achiever in Mormonism. We have no one in the humanities or in the social sciences who are even remotely classed as a world-recognized figure. We do have some major artists, such performing artists as Alexander Schreiner or Grant Johannesson, who are major figures, or composers such as Arthur Shepard, Leroy Robertson. But in intellectual life as we ordinarily think of it, there is none who is in the same category as Henry Eyring. Now, I'm able to say this not as a scientist, but frankly because I have had a great deal of association with major figures in the field of the sciences, and far more than I could even name at the present time have talked to me about Henry Eyring and his great stature as a leading scientist of this century. Two Nobel Prize winners in chemistry. One of them is dead now, Willard Libby, so I will mention him. The other one's still living, and I won't name him. Told me of their view that Henry Eyring long ago should have been recognized as a Nobel laureate. And in the case of Willard Libby, said he felt that his being a Mormon was the thing that prevented him from being a Nobel laureate. I think there is some evidence that if he had lived another 2 or 3 years, he would have received this great honor to add to the almost unbelievable list of honors which he did receive. I should say a word about his relations with the University of Utah, because this is what I was asked to comment on especially, and my views on his religious ideas. There's no one in the history of the University of Utah who is quite comparable to Henry Eyring in the things which he actually did for the university. I mean that his very presence on the university faculty attracted high-level students, high-level faculty, not simply in the field of chemistry, but in other areas as well. And millions upon millions of dollars for research. I wish, frankly, that there were time for me to exploit this a little more. But in the annals of the history of that university, though we have had some major figures in the presidency of the university and on the faculty, and particularly some major figures in the medical school who are there at the present time, such as Lou Goodman in pharmacology and Maxwell Wintrobe in hematology, people of great world stature, taking the university as a whole, Eyring has been a most remarkable influence upon the institution. Now, as to his religion, and our time is up, but I just say a word. I must say, and you know very well, that he was a remarkably devout person, a person of very genuine piety, a kind of loyalty to Mormonism as his religion, which is not found in very many of us. I mean, an absolute and total commitment, as far as I can tell. Now, I didn't agree at all with many of his religious views, and I must say that my first session with Henry Eyring was something of a disaster. his brother Leroy, who was a chemist at Berkeley, and his brother-in-law George Boyd, who was head of the institute there, arranged to get Henry and me together at Joe Eyring's home in Berkeley. That's another brother of Henry. I knew of Henry as a major scientist. He was in his first year at the University of Utah, and I was in the philosophy faculty of the University of Southern California. And these characters got us together for the purpose of staging a hassle, an argument. And I must tell you, it was one hell of a battle that Henry and I had that evening. And I was completely and totally exasperated. And the more he said, the more I couldn't believe that a person of such great stature as a scientist would say some of the things that he would say. And the madder I got, the more pleasant he became. He was having a good time. He was having a good time, and I was miserable. I had never talked to anyone who behaved the way he did. He thoroughly enjoyed the evening. Well, months later, a year and a half later, I joined the faculty of the University of Utah and became acquainted with him. And that is very well acquainted. And we became very close personal friends. For many years, our offices were within two or three doors of one another. And I talked to him almost every day. I was to discover that those very things which were such a source of exasperation to me were a part of his personal charm. He is a delightful person, filled with humor, and absolutely sincere in his commitment to his beliefs, even though it seemed to me that many of his beliefs were very naive and simplistic. A marvelous human being, if there ever was one. Now, if you want to read something that is filled with humor, you get the book recently published by his son, Hardin, which is entitled, I believe it was mentioned here, Reflections of a Scientist. This is a serious thing on science and religion, and it is one of the most humorous books that you will ever read in your life. Henry Eyring had a delightful, unbelievably opulent sense of humor. It was a very great man. As an individual, he was, in my opinion, probably far more sophisticated in his religious views than he liked to have appear on the surface. On the surface, he enjoyed a kind of appearance of simplicity and almost a childlike belief. But I was to learn that he was a very sophisticated person. I always had a feeling that he was a little bit like the case of Heber C. Snell's statement. And some of you, of course, were friends of Snell. Snell, in his later years, who was a real heretic, said, I'm orthodox. It's simply that I have my own doxy. I always had a feeling that Henry had his own doxy, which didn't show up always on the surface. And I'm astounded to learn that there are some people who in some way or another these days are inclined to question his religion because he believes that the Earth is perhaps, or the solar system, perhaps 4.5 billion years old and accepted evolution. He was a remarkably devout member of the church, a hard-working member of the church. It may be that he thought about molecules in his sleep when he was engaged in serious scientific discussion with a colleague, and he would immediately push the colleague aside or visitor and want to talk to me about Mormonism. So he was continually occupied with a religious interest as well as with molecules. He tried to get me to work with him on a book on science and religion. I could see that this was an impossibility. We didn't. His point was he would do the science side, I'd do the religion side. Well, I needn't say more about that. I needn't say more about anything.
I would like to thank Professors Heath and McMurrin. Sterling might not know it, but he's given me another reason why I should hope in an afterlife, so we could all get him and Henry together for another hassle. Thank you for your attendance.